You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Mic check. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I am your host, Dan Johnson. If you have listened to every single Nine Finger Chronicles podcast episode, you're sitting at like 897. I'm getting ready to break 900 episodes, I believe. And that's a lot of time spent sitting in a room talking into a microphone, either about deer hunting and things like that. And I can tell you this, that over the course of that time, I have learned a ton from other people. And it's, there's so many knowledgeable people out there about deer hunting. One thing that we already know is there's more than one way to kill a big buck. And, whether that's food plots and tower blinds, or it's habitat management, or it's public land, you know, running and gunning. There's so many different ways to do it, and you can do it in a combination of ways. And I really have enjoyed talking to just about every single person on this. I'll be honest. I think in the course of like all of these episodes, there's only been two that I can remember where while I was talking, I wanted to hang up the phone, right? God, this guy sucks or something like that, right? I'm not going to say who it is, but yes, I was frustrated while recording. I still put it out, whatever. But thank you is what I'm trying to get at. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And today's episode is no different, right? This is a guy, and let me back up a step. There has been talk recently about who is the best at what, whether that is habitat management or consulting, whether it's who's the best bow hunter or the best deer hunter or the best deer farmer or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of talk about that. And in my opinion, and here's what is frustrating for me, is it's frustrating for me because we have, how do I put this? Social media, right? In the social media world, we look at people who have a lot of followers, a lot of likes and clicks, and have a lot of clout in the social media game. But I'm here to tell you that I don't feel that that necessarily translates into real world scenarios. And whether that's hunting, or whether that is business, or whether that is habitat management, and what I'm getting at is today's guest, John Teeter of Whitetail Landscapes, is by far one of the most knowledgeable habitat consultants that I know of, habitat managers, deer, you know, whatever the case may be. If you want big bucks on your property, there's a specific way you need to go about this. Again, there's more than one way to skin a cat. However, this guy's approach to it is second to none, right? Just extremely knowledgeable about all things required to grow deer on your property, keep deer on your property, and provide them with a habitat that they don't want to leave, right? And so that's what today's topic is about, man. I don't talk about habitat management a lot just because I don't necessarily have the need for it in the world that I live in, because I don't own property. I don't have the ability to alter the habitat, plant food plots, things like that. I just can't do it. And so with that said, I am really looking forward to hearing John talk today because the dude's a stud, very knowledgeable. So that's what today's episode is about. I forgot to mention one thing, and that is that I am ready for my kids to go back to school. I wish I had a video camera in my house that you guys could just pop in and listen to how much they argue. Like, and sometimes it's not even arguing. I think my youngest son is just conditioned to where he is, if he is in the same room as my oldest son, he just goes, "Dad!" It's like, "What?" "Oh, I don't know." Like he whines about his older brother so much, it blows my mind. And so that's why I'm aging at a very rapid pace, I feel. And some days I feel like my heart is going to jump out of my chest because of the stress of being a father, if that's a thing. Anyway, enough of that. We got some commercials we got to do today. These are going to be real quick. Okay, I want to just drop some names here. I use all of these. I feel like all of them but one. I feel like there is a real opportunity for someone to change the way they hunt, improve the way they hunt through these products. All of them but one, just because I'm not allowed to use one of them. Dude, I have gone to the hybrid method of hunting, saddle hunting, being mobile, and I'm spending some time on a platform, some time in a tree stand, and 100% of the time in a saddle. So instead of my safety harness, I'm wearing a saddle. If you want to find out more about Tethered and all of the products they offer, tetherednation.com. Wasp Archery, dude, you want disgusting blood trails that have deer die from a ton of damage, wasparchery.com. Go check them out. Fixed blades, mechanicals. My two favorites are the three-blade jackhammer and the Boss four-blade. I do have a discount code, NFC20, for 20% off, wasparchery.com. Vortex Optics, they are it. They are him, as the kids would now say. These guys are the top of the pyramid for a reason, and that's because they have the best. They're the best. They have the best products. They have the best customer service. And when you have the best of the best, it allows your customers to be comfortable using your product and confident in them. And that's Vortex Optics. So go check out vortexoptics.com. By the way, it's velvet season right now here in Iowa. So here pretty soon, we're going to start taking trips as soon as the beans start to bud out here. And we're going to be driving gravel roads looking for big whitetail bucks in the bean fields. So go get a spotting scope from Vortex Optics. Next on the list is a product that I don't use, but I can see the functionality of it. And that's Feed Hub, right? So in Iowa, unless it's out of season, you can use a feeder. I don't have any feeders, so I don't use it. However, I've talked to some guys in states like Oklahoma and other places where you can run feeders, and they've really had, like, this product has really helped them be more efficient with their time, most importantly. And so the Feed Hub, basically what it does is it connects to SpinCast feeders, and you can control it through your cell phone, through the Moultrie mobile app. So if you have Moultrie mobile cell cams, you can use the Feed Hub through that same app. And it's really sweet, especially if you live a ways from your farms where you have feeders on it. So go check out MoultrieMobile.com and look up the Feed Hub there and read all about it. Next, Code Blue Sense. Dude, I freshened up my mock scrapes on one of my farms. I added a couple new mock scrapes in front of some trail cameras, and that's the secret recipe, right? My goal is to get deer to come in and visit this. Last year, I noticed that in September was the biggest month for pictures on my mock scrapes. And that is when the velvet comes off, deer are out there laying sign, they're getting ready for the breeding season, and they come and visit that rope hanging from that tree. So codebluesense.com, go check out their real synthetic deer urine, scent elimination products, and of course my favorite, the rope-a-dope I have a discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next, Huntworth. Huntworth has just released a new camel pattern called the Vertec. Today, I also launched a hunting gear podcast with Huntworth, and they talk all about their new camel pattern, why it's cool, why it's going to hit the market in a major way, and why you should go check it out. Huntworthgear.com. Go check out the new camel pattern Vertec. Okay. And then last but not least, well, I always say last but not least, but I have two more, Reveal trail cameras, dude. Bingo is what I'm going to say. Bingo. I'm glad I got them up. It took me 15 minutes to set up 8 cell cameras. And I believe the first one took the longest because, you know, there's a little bit of learning curve with all of the technology, but at once the first one was up and running, the next ones easy peasy. And, I'm on my Reveal app right now. Let me pull it up. I'm going to show you. You can't see anything, obviously, because this is I'm getting trail camera pictures every day. They're clear, crystal clear. The time that picture is taken to the time that it is sent to me is a matter, I'm guessing it's under a minute, right? It's under a minute. Really quick, really efficient, and it's just a badass way to get trail cameras to your phone. So bingo, bango. Go to tacticam.com/cameras and check out the new 3.0 versions of the Reveal trail camera. And last but not least, if you want to help a brother out, go to fullsneakgear.com and check out all of the t-shirts, hats, and sweatshirts that I offer. If you like deer hunting and you want to wear some deer on your chest, go check out fullsneakgear.com. Bingo. I don't know why I'm saying bingo today. I sound like a douche. Anyway, good vibes in, good vibes out, and enjoy today's episode, my friends. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today we are joined by Mr. John Teeter from Whitetail Landscapes. How are we doing, dude? It's been a while.
Good. Good, man. It has been a while. How you been?
I don't even know. it's summer vacation, and, dude, I love my kids so much. And if you listen to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, you're going to find out that my kids cause a lot of my stress, which I love them. They're very vibrant creatures, but they also cause me a lot of stress. And maybe it's because I'm not built to handle stress very well. I don't know. So when someone says, "Hey, how you doing?" I should learn to just go, "I'm doing okay. How about you?" You know, the answer that nobody really cares about.
Standard guy talk. You just got to go right to the point. Don't give too many details.
Exactly.
You know you're in pain like the rest of us, Dan. We all experience the same thing, brother.
That's a fact. I had a conversation with you the other day, and it kind of sparked an idea in my head. And, like, it's about habitat. Obviously, first off, just tell everybody, what do you do for a living?
Yep. So for a living, I am responsible a responsible individual that works with folks in the Northeast to design and optimize hunting properties. So there's an aspect of biology, vegetation management, like mechanical, you got to have experience with running equipment, using machinery, running chainsaws. There's a discipline related to just, I institute permaculture. I mean, there's just a whole host of aspects of this job that are so far superior, technically, than you would ever think to do a good job at this. Mm-hmm. The animal itself isn't complex, but the environment they live in is complex. So you have to learn how to kind of evolve in that state. So my job is basically ecological design and management, and I optimize these properties. So really hard to hunt areas are way easier. And it makes everyone's life a lot better when you're able to shoot the deer you want, or, you know, experience quality hunting, whatever your goal is. We try to meet the customer's goals. I mostly work in the Northeast, but this year I'm traveling. I'm going to Canada. I'm going down South. I'm going out West. I've kind of been all over the place, but I'm out of New York State. And I want to work in New York State as much as possible because I don't want to travel because I got kids.
Okay. All right. So hunting, land management, consultant, all this stuff kind of rolled into one. Okay. All right. And you said that the environment that these animals live in is very complex. All right. So when a client comes up to you and you have to ask them the question, like, what is important to you? What's your goal with this property? What is the most common answer?
Mostly, I want to shoot bigger quality deer. That's
Okay.
mostly what folks say. And
Okay.
that's such an abstract goal, Dan. Like that's about as high level as you possibly could get. And it requires you to look at the what is the particular makeup of that deer composition that allows you to shoot those high quality deer. What is a high quality deer to you? Because high quality deer to me may not be 160 class deer. It may have nothing to do with antler characteristics. That may be, a secondary trait or consideration.
Okay. So now I'm gonna ask a couple questions here in a kind of a devil's advocate type of approach to this. And so I hunt on a farm that I hunt on two different farms here in Iowa. Now, maybe just take Iowa out of this equation, because one farm has, in my opinion, good thick cover. There's water, there's food, there's browse, like everything a deer needs to survive. That farm also has a variety of bow hunters, shotgun hunters, late season hunters, mushroom hunters, turkey hunters. Like it's flooded with people throughout the entire course of the year, and the deer exist there. There's no management. They live hand in hand with livestock and an egg, egg operations. Okay. The other farm doesn't have good cover. It is mowed down to the grass. The grass is baled a couple times every summer. It's never been managed for deer, so the stem count lower to the ground is not there. Only in the summertime when the leaves fall off, it's wide open in there. But because there's no hunters, or it's been hunter free for several years, there's bigger antler deer that live there. Okay. And so my question to you is, if I come to you and I say, hey, John, I want bigger deer on my farm, is c could the answer also be don't shoot small deer?
Yeah, I mean that certainly could be the answer.
Okay.
I think the topic you brought up is interesting. I think this is really actually there's actually some level of complexity to this issue. So you
Okay.
got I don't care what state you're in. I don't care if you're in Mississippi, Iowa, North Carolina, New York, wherever you are. Pressure is pressure. Now, some of these deer have grown up in situations where they're very risk avoidance. And so when you get these larger deer herds, a lot of times the deer feel safer because they have multiple eyes. And so you design a property around pressure, whether it's hunting pressure or you're talking about cattle, whatever the impact is, there are going to be some individual deer that are very risk avoidant, and there are going to be some deer that are tolerant of risk. And in some of these environments, risk tolerance is everything. And so we work with clients to help create the least amount of risk on their property. And if there's risk around them, it amplifies interest. Big deer grow into, great deer if they have the right environment. Social stress is a huge piece of this. Though look at you and me, for example. If you and I had stress every single day, like meaning you have eight kids running around you in circles every day, is that not going to impact your physiology? It 100% will. Right? It may make you do things that you don't normally do. And so that's the same thing with deer. Their physical state and their mental state is critical. And when I'm starting to assess like hunting deer or attacking a deer, I'm evaluating its physical being on the landscape, meaning how does it interact with other deer? How does it interact with its landscape? That's a huge part of making decisions on when and how to kill a deer. And so anybody in the country can take that bit of advice and start applying to their property. The whole concept of sanctuaries is only because we're trying to create a risk-reduced environment. And if you have lower risk on the property, they're going to spend more time there. And there's going to be studies over the next 10 years where they're going to say, hey, we're trying to create these ultimate properties. What are the conditions that prevail that create more interest in your property? Well, I can tell you, on 46 acres here in Tully, New York, which is like, you know, anti-Iowa from when it comes to quality, I have as good as quality as probably you in soil, as well as just the environment, and actually a decent deer population now because I've created that similar environment risk avoidance type example that you're talking about earlier. They don't have any risky issues on my property, and it's a sanctum for them. And so, you know, those are one of the critical things I think people should start playing out. Like, do I have a property that has a lot of pressure? And what does that actually mean? Did this deer grow up in a pressure environment? The deer psychological status is really important in the whole concept of designing a hunting property.
So risk in your eyes, risk equals pressure.
Yeah, it's one of the factors in that. And you know, drought could be a similar issue where it creates stress. So look at all the stressors that create an issue with a deer. And, you know, certainly human presence is a huge piece of that, right? So the more presence you apply, the more you displace deer. That's, you know, simple equation. But maybe you can design it so when you displace them, they don't run off the property. Or they're going to go in an area where there's a sanctum, right? They're, where they feel secure.
Yeah. Okay, so guy comes up to you and he says, I want to shoot bigger bucks, right? That's why you're here. I want bigger bucks, okay? Because, because realistically, people are shelling out money to you, to a variety of other land consultants and habitat management money, right? I also agree that money can buy bigger deer. In some aspect, whether it's going to an outfitter, doing habitat management and food plots and all, like the whole gamut on your own individual property, whatever the case may be. But if deer, like, I don't know what I'm trying to get at here. Like, money is driving all of these people to do that, right? And so how do you, knowing that you make your money off, like, trying to accomplish this goal of bigger bucks, also tell these people that we're going to do everything that we can to try to do this, but it's not guaranteed?
Yeah, I think that's the, you know, that's the honesty that you have to have with people. Like, I can't put a deer and lasso it and tie it to a tree and say, this is a deer you're going to kill.
Yeah.
But what I can do is I can create at least the habitat where they're more inclined to be present on the property. There's a simple equation here, and it's really basic. Good habitat equals good deer. Mm-hmm. And if you hunt it smart and you manage it correctly, those things change. Like, so you could have all the money in the world. You could buy 1,000 acres, 5,000 acres, right? You get these different people to go in and promote all these practices, whether it's burning, it's disking, it's timber management, it's forest stand improvement, whatever the tactic that you're using, it has to relate to some outcome. So what we do is we take a goal and, like, we want bigger deer. Okay, what is the status of your deer currently? How are we going to measure that? Like, maybe you look at the physiology of the deer. What's the retention, right? How many deer do we actually pull back or create as these deer reproduce? Like, how many fawns are we retaining? What are the environments we're creating to grow or shrink a population? Like in Iowa, you know, I have anywhere between 18 to 30 deer per square mile on average across New York State. That's a pretty good average. Now, areas in the western part of the state are in the 60s, 70s, 80s. I was anywhere between 50 to 150. And so what does that do? It creates more stress in the environment, not only stressing the deer out, but actually stressing the habitat or quality habitat out. So if you, these guys that are buying these 5,000 acre properties, owning land is one important thing, but making it a top tier property creates a whole bunch of work and effort. And so the money suck is you can have a smaller property and really be productive because nobody else around you is doing anything. Or you have this really big property, and then you're taking yourself to the next level. And one of the goals in some of these really big properties, like in Texas, is the fawns that they're dropping on their property, they're staying within the realm of that farm. Now, they're not all fenced in, but, you know, they're staying in that wild ground, and they're creating these great environments. They're creating the most available food. And when the deer need the most level of protein is in that early development stage, you know, where they have high demands for calcium and phosphorus and aminos. That's in that early fawning stage. If you provide a good, healthy habitat, we want very tight breeding windows and good quality environment for escape cover and, you know, just increasing the food availability. you're going to be successful. And how do you do it in the cheapest, quickest way possible? That's kind of my job, is how do we speed up the process? And if you buy like crappy ground, meaning it may be 1,000 acres, but you have terrible soil, I mean, that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars you have to put into each acre of soil to improve it to have the high quality food. And what we try to teach people is increase the food value so much where the deer don't want to leave. And even your pressure can sometimes, as much as you want to disturb them, they want to stick to good. And that's always the equation. Good deer want to be in good properties. And that's simply it. So I can find good properties just looking at soil composition before I even look at the environment. And that's kind of how I distinguish.
This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
Are you in a situation we're going to need to invest a lot of money? Or are we good with that? We just need to work on some timber, create better movement, management, flow, travel corridors, all the factors that come into creating good opportunities. And holding deer, and that's a factor. How do you hold deer on your property?
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
Are your clients, do they want to play a role in what it is that you do? Or do they just go, here's my budget, do whatever you want to it, I just want to see bigger deer?
Most of my clients over the past 2 years have been, we want you to come do your consulting bit. Sometimes they want me to stay for 2 or 3 days and cut with them and work with them on their property just to help that continuity.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys want to take that information and run with it. And okay. That's one aspect of it. We got clients that are turnkey clients where you go in and do all the work. And many times those people are sped up, right? They've got too many things going on. They're running businesses. They don't have opportunity. They just want to show up.
Yeah.
And you don't have the same relationship with those folks, which, you know, of course would bother the normal guy because you're like, wow, you're not invested like I'm invested in your property. Mm-hmm. But that's not always the case either. Some of those guys are just invested. They don't have the time. So you communicate with them more frequently, but it's not like in a work situation, meaning you're not in the field doing the actual work with them. So they miss out on some stuff, but you know, it depends on your means and what your goals are and your time and effort and interest. And money is time and time is money. So people have to look at how much time they're willing to invest in something. You know, if you're a guy that makes $500 an hour, it's probably not worth it for you to go cut timber or maybe $150 an hour, right? Maybe it's worth paying somebody $100 an hour to do that because it's too strenuous. There's risk involved, insurance, equipment, whatever the case may be. So with our clients, we sit down and say, hey, what time availability do you have? And then break, what do you want to do? Like, what do you want to do on this prep rate? What do you want your role to be? And we define that with them. I've had clients where they don't even show up. They send a manager in to work with me to work on their job. And the client doesn't even show up, right? They're off in, you know, whatever, doing, you know, whatever and making, you know, money. And usually it's money driven. Not always, right? People have other priorities, but certainly everyone has different obligations. And you have to understand that. But you have to connect with these clients enough. Because I work with guys that are normal guys. Like, they don't make $60,000 a year, right? They make just the bare minimum, but they have these properties and, you know, they're willing to invest in it. And they've been saving for 3 years for me to come out to their property. And that day is huge for them. And so that doesn't change my relationship. I work the same way with them as the guy that's got all the money, but I really need them to be successful. And that means that they've got to figure out what their goals are. And I help define that. And then we walk through a process. It's a decision tree analysis of how to achieve those goals based on their time, their money, right? All those things that go involved with that.
Okay.
All right. So you mentioned the term, like I hear a lot of habitat managers, consultants say, and that's holding deer. You know, you gotta hold deer on your property all year round.
Yeah.
And so I have a property down, that's the property that I've hunted for the most years, and it is a summer bonanza. And I mean, there's giants that hang out. There's tons of deer, very, not only quality, but quantity are in on this farm. The second the velvet comes off, they redistribute. Okay. From your experience, what are they doing? Why do they redistribute? And then also, what could be done from a habitat standpoint to improve that so they don't redistribute and they all kind of stick around, or most of them stick around?
Yeah, so this has been a huge problem for a lot of these properties that are ag dominated, if there's a lot of agriculture, and a lot of it's block timber. And so how do you create more usable space that's functional all season long? That's the goal. So what you do is you just simply look at your demographic of your vegetation. You know, let's say you got a lot of timber, or maybe you don't have a lot of timber. What is the status of that timber? What's the age class? What's the diversity? What's the value of food related to the timber? And so we try to regenerate areas where there's enough food seasonally to keep them hold over so they stick around the property. Now, one of the things I've been working on over the years is trying to define this a little bit better, but, you know, deer have a core range and a home range. And core is, you know, tight, you know, think of the center of an apple. And then the home range is a larger span where they may, you know, open that up during breeding season, but, you know, an area where they frequent around. Now, on these properties that are more, most of my area in New York, it's mostly woodland dominated and forest dominated. In those particular situations where they're forest dominated, it's really easy to shrink their core area with vegetation. Really easy to do that. In your areas, they prefer those because there's been this cadence of movement over time. Like, think of it like a historical, like, pictogram where all these deer are so used to going in these areas, you got to change the trend. So you got to get a little extreme on that. So one of the things you do is you bulk up and provide as much food as you can, seasonality, meaning during the time that they're going to leave. The other piece of it is you have to create the right volume of cover. Cover changes all the time. One of the goals is creating, the term we use is thermal neutrality. And we want to make sure that the deer stay cool or stay warm during the right times of year. Comfort is a big piece of this. You know, you can't put like a comfort scale, but you sit in that really comfortable chair, you know, in your neighbor's, you know, family room. And that chair is better quality. It's got better leather. It's a little more plush. You got to create these comfort factors on these properties. So some of that is just how you build habitat. So one of the things we do is within the bedding areas specifically, we add food to bedding areas. And that seems like counterproductive because you want deer to move around the landscape. But realize to create these sanctums, the deer need certain features. And the certain features is safety. And we go back to this whole risk avoidance thing. If you can create enough food within a bedding area and you stack deer and you have enough food value, the deer don't have to leave. And that's 90% of the goal. So these little small timber lots, if there's enough food availability and they're not depleting the entire landscape, depending on the population, then you're probably in a good shape to shift their interest into your property. Security cover is huge. That's a major factor in deer selecting certain locations. Bucks, for example. Bucks want space. They want space within their cohort, so within the bachelor groups. Some bucks are more individualistic. They want larger volume of space. There's a concept called depth of cover, which is a fallacy. It's been promoted all through the industry, through the internet. Jeff Sturgis does a good job talking about different factors of it. But on my properties that I design, we don't have depth of cover. I'm stacking buck next to doe, next to buck, next to doe. Some deer don't like that naturally. They just are inclined to want space. But some deer become accustomed to it. Good example. Don Higgins is a super well-known habitat consultant out there. Charges a lot of money, has a great property in Illinois. He's got an island property. These deer are so familiar with being integrating and having social stress, but they're used to it. And they grow up in that environment, and they're used to congregating into his property. He separates them and creates space and does a lot of things that we're talking about here. But they don't experience the same stressors that you might have when you have some of these properties that are completely depleted with food and don't have the cover value. So a lot of times it's creating that balance between cover and food. And like I said earlier, risk preferences and avoidances. And I could create a property where in a lot of instances, the big bucks stick around. They don't leave. Now, naturally, some deer are just going to leave because they've had that cadence of movement of leaving. But you can change a deer's home range and core range based on the improvements that we're making. And I've got plenty of examples of that with clients and myself where, you know, that deer wasn't on my property, you know, 2 years ago when he was a 2-year-old, and all of a sudden as a 4-year-old, he's on the property and he's on it, you know, more frequently than he's ever been. And I'm killing him, you know, within hours of me trying to, you know, make a decision. And I'm, you know, I've got the data. He gives me a tell. I go kill him. Game over. And I've had instances where I haven't been successful killing the deer, but I've at least held them on my property. And that's normally the goal that you're trying to create. But a lot of it's a food cover value aspect of it and diversifying your property. It's 90% of the issue.
Okay. So you used the term just now, depth of cover.
Yes.
Okay. Explain. So is that a bad thing or a good thing?
No, it's just a theory that you know, Jeff Sturgis promotes it. And this is a great conversation because, you know, his perception is that certain deer have to stack behind other deer. There's an understanding amongst a lot of people that do this that deer want space. And I do agree that deer want space, and certain individual deer may want more space than other deer. I'm not disputing that. What I'm saying is, in some examples, I've been able to stack deer closer to each other. So, like,
because
if you're going to
hunt cover.
What would you say?
Because of the cover. That has
because
been
of
created.
The value of
okay.
cover. And it's okay. It's how you create cover in the landscape. And some of it has a lot to do with just orchestrating layering, having layering within bedding areas. Good example on a food plot, so people have like common understanding what this is. So I just had this big habitat day on my property. I had like, you know, 20 clients out, and I did a big presentation, and, you know, they're up and down. My property has ton of elevation changes. It's one of the most unique properties that I think I know any of these clients have ever seen. And it's created this basic focus on layering. And layering could be even a food plot where you have a shrub, a grass, a conifer, a shrub, a grass, a conifer. You have like these individual layers, and that creates buffers. And buffers, depending if they have a food value or a cover value, are a resource. And so if you create these resources and you increase food value, it's really not hard to get deer to stack within an area. And so, you know, it's the depth of cover is kind of washed away because I could stack a buck and a doe and a mature buck next to a group of does within close proximity on these little islands and points. And it's a lot of it's topography driven. Topography sometimes dictates where deer are going to be. So how do you maximize that location with the topography in mind. And that has a lot to do with managing vegetation and cutting. And that's really where we've kind of really like fine tuned the design in a property. So I can take any property, you know, anywhere, and I can employ some of these tactics and change the whole prescription on how often the deer use it, you know, how to control their movement in and on an area, how to take data on them. And it works. I mean, I've done it all over the country.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you're alluding to here, as far as deer needing space, is carrying capacity. And so how do you identify when you go into a property, or once the property is completed, you know, you go in, you do your thing 5 years later, you know, now it's to where like we've reached this goal from a habitat standpoint. How do you identify whether or not the carrying capacity of a farm is high or low?
So the simple way to do it, and I think a lot of people just want the simple answer to this, is you take...
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
You know, you have a food plot and you think about the amount of biomass in that food plot and you can calculate it. Like, let's just say, for example, corn, which is a seasonal plant, probably not a good example. You're producing anywhere to 5 to 10,000 pounds of food, you know, roughly per acre. That's kind of an average. But if you're doing clover, you can go in there and cut like a foot by foot section or a 10 by 10 section. And then you got this exclusion cage. And like, for example, my property, I put out an exclusion cage the beginning of the month. And every month I check it and I see how it compares versus another area. And then I measure how much biomass is eaten. And then it gives me kind of an indicator of high, medium, low. So I know in that food plot that they're frequently often, you know, they're often up there. I can figure out how much they're consuming on that food plot within a 30-day cycle. So Then I can figure out how much deer I'm feeding, and I can do rough estimates. I mean, there's other ways to do this, to do population studies. I mean, thermal drones are fantastic where you can legally use them. You can at least get a number, an idea of numbers. But on my property, for example, you know, I average, and my cameras prove this, I average anywhere between 12 to 15 deer daily. So how many mouths do I need to feed? So how much food do I need on a per day basis? It's 6 to 8 pounds of wet matter. If you just take a tote and you fill it up about 3/4 full, you know, one of those, I don't know how many gallons, 25 gallons, 3/4 full, that's about 6 to 8 pounds. It's a lot of food per deer. So you're figuring out how much food you need to feed per deer. So when you go in, you start looking at preferential foods, how much are they depleted? Even within forested ground, if you take a fence and lock off a 10 by 10 section and measure how much edible food is in there, you can compare it against a square acre and say, all right, well, I have about this much food. This equates to this much dry matter. This is how many deer I can feed. And that's how you start to come up with this food value concept. And I think exclusion cages are great in the woods, in the fields, and you can do simple math. I mean, it's not hard to take something and weigh it and compare it against what you actually have. And so what I do is I'll have multiple exclusion cages in a field. I'll set them up in 30 days. I'll compare it against what's adjacent to it, and I'll do the math. And it's like weighing something, you know. It's really not hard, and you can weigh it instantaneously. I got these little small scales. I bring them with me. I weigh the food, and okay, I've got 3,000 or 4,000 pounds, you know, eaten at this period of time. You know, in this month, you know, I may, on those food plots, I may lose, you know, 1,000 to 1,200 pounds a month. It sounds like a lot, but how much am I producing, right? And that's something about understanding, you know, what deer eat and why. And these diverse food plot blends are also kind of interesting because I think they're giving the deer a really diverse diet. You know, you've seen these like 16 species blends, and, you know, it gets a little complex, you know, with just, you know, what type of food is in there and how you equate now what the volume of biomass is that's edible. So,
So you improve a property, right? And you, let's say you don't hunt it. If you improve a property, you don't hunt it, more deer are going to come live on this thing, right? And then you're fighting against an increased population of animals, right? And so now you need more and you need more and you need more. Okay. So what I'm getting at here is once you've implemented habitat improvement and you've gotten the deer to stick around, maybe even the does are having their fawns and they're not leaving. The Bucks aren't leaving. Everybody's sticking around. How then do you equate how many deer need to be removed off that property every single year?
So the recruitment piece of this is big. So once those does take up space and they're producing fawns, those fawns are going to stick around, right? And so you got to figure out how many deer you're retaining. So there's residential deer and then there's non-residential deer. Mm-hmm. And so over time on some of these larger properties, like they've got all the food late season, all of a sudden a plum of deer come into the property and they just devour it, right? And I think I've talked to the juries about this issue, right, on their property, because I know their habitat manager. And so one of the things we try to do is knock down the resident deer population. Like trigger control management is the focus. Figure out what you're comfortable with and how many deer you can feed. That's a calculation. Figure out how many are residential and then how many fawns you're bringing to the equation. So every fawn you recruit, some are going to disperse. One of the good examples that I've been doing on my property, because I have so many deer, is this summer I've been over there almost every single day. Now I got bucks frequenting the property, but they're not at the volume that they normally are because I'm pushing them off. I'm trying to preserve some of the food, some of the woody material for late season, because I'm short on late season food on my particular property because it's only 46 acres. I got 1.7 acres of food plots, and then I manage the rest for vegetation. So I would say for most people, figure out what you think your capacity is based on the volume of food, and think about it seasonally, and then think about your recruitment number. So how many fawns, how many deer, and how many deer are immigrating your property? Now, one thing that NDA might tell you is, you know, you take a statistic, look at your fawn and deer population in September, don't look at it again, and make your decisions. Right. I kind of disagree with that. I think if you got these deer coming into your property and they're coming from, you know, your neighbor's property and they're now becoming more frequent because you got this metropolis, those deer might have to die. So I think some of it depends on their frequency. Then it's getting really intimate with which deer on your property, which honestly is really hard to do with some of these does. So now you're looking at age demographics. You know, what are they consuming? Like older deer, bigger deer, they eat more food, right? And younger deer eat better quality food. And so there's kind of a difference in some of the things are focused around what food you have when. And I think you need to understand when you have the highest volume of food and does that equate to this overlap of when deer are on your property. And you kind of got to match the two up, if that makes sense. So you might do more cutting to have more woody vegetation in the winter months because you have this influx of deer on your property. And sometimes you can't hunt during that time of year. So what do? Go put pressure on your property. Kick them off. Go over there every day. You know, I have low deer populations in my area, so I don't have to worry about these issues as much. But I work out in Ohio, and there's tons of deer. And I say, put pressure on your property. When you're not hunting, put pressure on your property. Keep them off your land. Because, again, deer know what good is. And this is totally opposite of what most people say. Leave it alone. Don't touch it. No way. Kick them off. Get them out of there. Shoot as many does as you can. Shoot the low quality bucks that are on your property of the right age class. And that could be 2-year-olds. You know, you could be displacing or shooting 2-year-olds. And that might be a good thing, depending on where you are, what your goals are.
Yeah. Elaborate on that right there. Like eliminating low quality bucks, because I hear that and I go, why would you shoot young deer?
Yeah. I think I always start with, in my area, we focus on maturity. So if I can get a deer to 3 years old, that's a great thing. If it gets to 4, it's even better. So antlers really don't matter. Mm-hmm. But on a lot of these properties where they're larger, they have more opportunity to kind of manage the deer. They're starting to get to that 2-year-old age class where they see the potential differences in quality. Now, deer do make jumps, and it's hard to be fully aware of what that jump may be, but they typically have trends. So if a deer falls outside of the bell curve, meaning its antler quality is such where it's not within, you know, the average standard, that deer could likely get killed. But if it's at average or above average, then based upon the number of deer and your ultimate goal of maybe growing trophy class whitetails, you can call out some of those younger deer. That doesn't mean that those deer won't disperse either. Like, let's say you've got a neighbor that's doing all the stuff that you're doing. You may lose that deer to quality habitat. So you're constantly in this competition mode of what deer you can retain. And also going back to the social piece of it, you know, Dan, you got to realize some of these deer have individual preference. you got a bully buck on a property, guess what? It dies. I just did a podcast on this on my own where I talked, you know, on the Whitetail Landscapes podcast, I talked a little bit about, you know, what deer live and die and what my theories are on my property. And so if it's a doe that has this like social eclectic, like doesn't get along with other does, it dies. So part of my decision to kill a deer may be related to, you know, how it physically and, you know, it interacts with other deer on the landscape. Same thing with big bucks. Bully bucks die. They yeah. usually don't stand the chance on properties like mine. So I'll prefer a bully buck over a more sedentary and like deer that doesn't have the same, you know, mannerisms.
Dude, and that bully buck thing is real. I watched a dude, he was a gigantic body and he was 125-inch 8-pointer.
Yep.
Wide, short tines, like put him on a wall. People were like, why would you shoot this deer type of buck, right? But he was probably, I'm going to guess, 5-6-year-old, big, mature deer. He came, and when he showed up on the farm last year and the year before, later November, he kicks every other deer out, every other mature buck. During the late season one year, I watched him come into a food plot on the neighbor's farm, and he kicked every single buck off of that food plot. And then he fought with one as well. And so I can see how that is a huge part of management.
Well, you bring up a point and you just said it right there. Like aesthetics is everything for people. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with human nature, right? The guy always wants the pretty girl. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with deer. We perceive these things to be, you know, important, and antlers have become important to people. And what was really important is having healthy deer mm-hmm. and having healthy environments for deer. And so we've kind of missed the boat there. And you can have high quality deer that like great environments. They may have these personalities that you kind of got to rid out. But the reality of it is we're missing the boat and we're looking at things totally wrong. And, you know, I've been able to kind of shape and change people's way of thinking, at least in my circles. And I realize that not everyone, you know, buys into that. Like everybody wants that, you know, big giant truck with 400 horsepower, right? I drive a Subaru Outback. I don't need to walk around with a big stick. And so what I want people to realize is when you're designing these hunting properties, there's a lot of little small things that you can do. It's not about antler quality all the time. It's about creating the right environments. And sometimes it's the atmosphere. Like if we go to a bar and it's just got a good vibe, it's really one of those things where you just know it's got a good vibe. The people are there, the environment's there, there's nobody fighting. It just has a great environment. And think about that like your hunting property. I don't want a lot of fighting. I don't want a lot of discord. I want people to get along. And that's the same thing with deer. And that's a great environment to create this opportunity. And I think a good property can be excellent. And I've seen a lot of people take their good properties where they're shooting 150 class, 160 class deer and take it to the next level. And they're really assessing the deer differently. And they're looking at their environments differently. I think there's the next level. It's really hard. Most of my client base is new to this. They're trying to understand how to just get going. But those that are advanced, you know, it's really easy to take them to that next level, that top tier farm. And, you know, those are great clients to have. And a lot of those clients are in the Midwest, which is tough because I'm a Northeast guy. And that's, right. You know, I can't replicate that here as easily.
Right, right. Okay. So I've been thinking about this recently. About who's telling the story, who is promoting their thing, right? And what kind of knowledge base do they have to promote a certain message, right? And so you look at this in social media, right? And that would be somebody with a big amount of numbers, followings, YouTube channels. You know, they're coming out and they're saying, hey, you should try to do this or you do this or watch me how I do this. And maybe their knowledge base isn't there, but people think they are the figure to listen to because they have giant numbers in social media or YouTube and things like that. So I don't want I don't want you to call out any names per se, but what is one thing that you see in this habitat management environment industry that really just is like pisses you off because I don't know, from a scientific standpoint, from a management standpoint, from a business standpoint, things like.
Well, I want to say one thing that I think is important. I think that it's important to look at, like, I'll bring up Jeff Sturgis as a good example. He's been on this podcast, and I don't know Jeff personally, but what I like about some of these guys is those platforms give them a chance to change people's state of mind and thinking. So right. It's critical. So you can't abuse that, right? That's important. And there's never one way to skin a cat. There's right. always many different options. So nobody's 100% correct. Normally, there's an 80% solution to 100% of the issues. That's normally what I think. There's so many things that are new now that the hunting community is not tied to. So you may be really like involved in like a Grant Woods YouTube channel and really immersed in his process. And it doesn't apply to your situation. You don't have the same soil type, climatic conditions, right? There's so many differences, but there isn't enough identified for you to understand what those differences may be. So people are not really inclined to understand fully what their environment provides to them. In some places, you know, you have the sky's the limit and you just don't know it and you don't know what to do. So one of the things I will say that I think is really important is, and I think this would be important for you, and I think it's important for any listener on this, go try hard. And what I mean by that is it could be, you know, it could be a marathon. It could be hunting. Go try hard. Go experience something more difficult than you currently are in and push yourself. Now, I know you do that, right? I know you go on hunts and maybe you feel at some point, I got no business being out here, right? I don't know. I don't even know how to handle this.
I've
seen you go through it.
And Every year.
And I think that's the best part of you. I think that makes you so real with people. And that's why people relate to you. But if you're doing this, like you're working on your hunting property and you want to go experience hard, come out to New York, come out to New Hampshire, come out to Connecticut and struggle with us through the seasons and look at what those differences may be and appreciate what we experience. Because what that's going to do is going to give you perspective and it's going to make you change how you approach things. The other piece of it is there is more science data out there. Not studied stuff that's in this world, meaning not in the deer world, but ecological that's applicable. I'm studying stuff that is like, I don't want to say it's far beyond, but it's so significantly different than in the deer world that you would be amazed at how simply, like one example, next week, I mean, I'm on the road this week here. I'm with clients the rest of the week, right? Next week. But when I get back, I'm changing the microbiology on my property in such a way where I have more production, meaning I'm processing nutrients at a such a higher rate. I'm mineralizing like phosphorus at such a high rate because my deer need high levels of phosphorus because I have deficient phosphorus across the landscape. And what does that do? It makes it good. And you know how I measure that? I have tools where I can look at through a microscope, or I can do sap analysis or do leaf analysis, and I can look at the sugar levels of those plants. And I know that high sugar content equals high interest. And so I'm looking at things at a little bit finer level than most habitat managers because I'm in a really tough area. And I think going through tough gives you perspective. And I think people should start pushing themselves to experiencing difficulty because when you do that, it'll change your ultimate experience. It'll push you to that next age class. It'll push you to that, you know, that next management decision. You know, maybe you get away from fire. Fire isn't always the best option for people. And everyone promotes fire as the number one resource management tool. It's not. And it's not here in the Northeast. We have it's very wet here. Fire regime is not predominant in this environment. It's not a technique and tool that you can use very frequently. I'm not saying you can't use fire or you shouldn't use fire. I'm just saying there's differences and you should explore those differences and go see different things. Take a class in New York with John Teeter. Go to Don Higgins' masterclass. Go to these other areas. Go across the country and see what other people are doing. You'll get great ideas on how to employ change on your property. Have a consultant come to your property that's not ever worked in your area. That's a smart person that can figure out your ecoregion and different ecotypes and how to explore those because ecotypes drive how I approach a habitat design. And I think some of these people can't spell ecotype. They're doing this professionally and that's not calling people out, but really do your research on some of these guys that are coming out and doing this. I'm like, you're good hunters. Cool. This is way beyond hunting. Yeah. You know, if this is all about hunting,
That was the point I'm trying to make here. You know, just real quick, do you have an education in this field?
No, okay. I don't. I'm completely self-taught. And I think that I have a legal background, which you probably don't know. I've got a technical engineering background. So how does that apply? Honestly, the way it applied was I started doing this over 20 years ago. I'm 42 now. So when I was in my 20s, I was doing some of the stuff I'm still doing today. And I just took a different approach than most people. And I think that really kind of changed my perspective. And now I take tons of training classes. I've gotten the education. I just don't have a bachelor's degree in biology. And I don't think I need it, because I think the level of experience that I have, I'm teaching foresters and biologists. I mean, I'm helping them explore how to do this better, which shows that you've started to hit the pinnacle. And where I've excelled is I know that I don't know everything, and I'm continuing to learn, and that's been why my business has excelled, and having a fresh look at everything, taking maybe a more engineering design kind of philosophy and applying it to habitat management, totally applicable, because a lot of it's mechanical. So it's just an interesting thought.
All right. What is harder, the initial setup of a farm, for whether it's you or whether it's you're telling a landowner what to do? Is it the first, let's say, 2 years on a property to implement it, or is it the rest of the time maintaining?
It depends on how you cut it and how you manage it. So I have areas of my property where I have to do very infrequent work the way that I cut it. So what we've done is a lot of my clients are anywhere between 55 and 65. So how do we make it easy for them to do the work? So if you cut it right and you do the work and you allow yourself to, have machinery to get in there. Like, for example, you have a flail mower and you go in there and cut everything really easily. You don't have to do it by hand. That's going to save you time and effort. Getting the property set up is the biggest thing, because people don't realize how much work is involved. Most clients on 100 acres or less should be averaging 35 or more days on an annual basis just doing habitat work. 35 days. Now, it's hard for Dan Johnson and John Teeter to get 35 days a year just to do habitat work, beyond all the hunting. But all that does is make your hunting easier and makes your environment better to attract and hold deer. Mm-hmm. So it's a win on the back end of it. But I think it takes the biggest leap of faith is to get going. And most of the time, it's hard for people to translate a design, a prescription, and what do I do next? Like, what are the steps that I need to take? And people are very simple. They want it simple. So you got to make sure that you're going to give them the best bang for the buck and give them the direction they need. It's going to be different if you lay out a property for fire with a fire regime than you would with a forest management plan that doesn't have fire. They're totally two different philosophies and techniques, and your layout's going to be different. Yeah. So I think a lot of it has to do with, what are your issues? What are your ultimate goals? And defining some of those such where you can put the right time and effort getting into a particular area and making change. So if you don't set it up right, you get screwed on the backside with a ton of maintenance. So I'll just give you one last thing, because this podcast is going to come out next week with me, because I had this masterclass. One of the questions that was asked, because I had a guy interview me on the podcast, and he asked me the question, I thought you'd cut more. And I said, I don't want the maintenance. The more I cut, the more maintenance I have. And if I'm not cutting the right trees, all I'm doing is setting myself up for more work. I want the least amount of work and the most amount of output. And he was like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah. So to your point, Dan, I think if you set up the property right for the first 2 years and you cut it right and you manage it right, the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years are a lot easier. And the maintenance should be the fun part. Your 35 days go down to 20 days. So,
Yeah. All right. So people listen to this and they go, oh my God, maybe I should have a consultant come to my farm, take a look at it, whether it's 1,000 acres or whether it's 20 acres, whatever the case is. How do I go about looking for a habitat consultant or a property manager or whatever I know those are two different things, a habitat consultant, a habitat improvement company, whatever the case is. What's the first thing as a potential client that I should be looking for to where I get the best results out of the dollar that I'm giving him.
All right. So money matters for most people. So I think money's always the factor. You know, consultants are anywhere between, I've seen, you know, pretty inexpensive consultants. They're $1,700 to, you know, call consultants that are $10,000 for a day. So figure out what your budget is. Now, beyond that, figure out somebody that you actually can relate to that has similar experience to you. Now, the guy that manages 10,000 acres that does it once a year, right, that's focused on that property, knows that ecotype. Has he traveled a lot? What experience does he have in your region? That's important. I think understanding ecoregions. I've had to travel quite a bit, so I've had to study different ecoregions. Deer are deer, but deer are different. So in the Northeast, I feel like there's a different type of, they're the same species, but their mentality or their emotional state or mental state's a little different. Right. That will change the way that you approach deer. So if there's a consultant that's done a lot of work in really tough areas, I would argue that they have a different perspective. Now, the other piece of it is, what's your deer population like? I think that's another factor I'd ask. Like, do you have high deer population or low deer population? And asking the consultant around those questions, like, well, what do you do in this example? I think you should put together 4 or 5 critical questions that you ask the consultant that are meaningful to you, that depending on the response, interview them, depending on the response, how they respond to that, what does that actually, does that trigger a response like they know what they're talking about or not? The last piece of it is knowing, will that consultant stay with you after the work that they do? So if I just give you a map and I walk away and that's all you want, and you don't want any follow-up and you're cool with that, that's one. But a lot of my clients, what happened is they want to do an exit interview. They want to interview. Like, I talked to a client I worked on 2 years ago. He called me yesterday and had 5 questions. We scheduled the meeting. We have 5 questions. We bang them out. He's done, right? He got his information. And by the way, that just helps me understand where he's at and his level of success. So figure out a guy that's going to stick around with you. The last piece of it is, how are you going to do the work? Sometimes you need to be shown how to do the work. So if they're a consultant that comes out and just says, here's your map, you know, good luck, you know, or they're willing to follow up with you, but they're not willing to do the work, then you're kind of lost a little bit. You may not be able to do the implementation work. So through that whole discussion point, figure out somebody you're comfortable with, someone that is going to be able to follow through with you, and then someone that's willing to help you if you need help, and that has expertise to do that. Some of these guys only do consulting in the wintertime because it's easy to look at the landscape. It's easy walking. Well, the best time to consult is in August and September, right before hunting season. I can see all your deficiencies on the landscape. Things have started to success a little bit. So you get to see, you know, what the status of your environment is, your quality of vegetation.
That's a great point.
You get a great scout before season. So if somebody's only doing it in the winter months, they missed out on the whole gamut of what is your hunting going to look like before the season. Most of my consulting, like, I've got client after client right now. This is the best time to consult for me. And I push clients off in August and September because I'm helping them for hunt season. I can tell them what food plot, you know, a lot of people want to focus on food plot, but seed to put in at this point in time, right, for late season. And then also, you know, I'm giving them great prescription of where they're going to be, where they have good opportunity to kill, what are the improvements they need to make or could make on the property. And it's real-time information for them. And most of the consultants aren't working, they stop, right? I think there's only a few that continue all year. I mean, I do all year consulting. I take 2 months off a year. And that's during hunting season for me. And I still will cut timber. I cut timber in October last year on a client property in Ohio. So, you know, I still work.
Yeah.
If I have to.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, there's a lot there. I mean, from this conversation today, and I know that from and I know you because I've talked with you before and I listened to your podcast and I know how detailed you are about the work that you do, which to this day blows my mind of whenever for every podcast that comes into the network, I'll listen to little bits of it to make sure the audio quality is correct. And listening to you and your guest, or you and a past consultant, or another a client, or you and another consultant, like, talk is just like blows my mind about the attention to detail and the levels that go into how you approach habitat management or hinge cutting. Like, when a guy has an entire podcast dedicated to like one or two specific plants, That tells you right there that this guy's serious about what he does. And it's not a, oh yeah, here's how you do it. You hinge cut, you plant food plots, and you burn, right?
Yeah.
There's so much more than that.
Yeah. We have, you know, that whole concept of that, you know, when I replaced Land and Legacy, the whole concept was, you know, how do I bring my business to the forefront? And then how do I bring other people along with that, but also learn from those other people? And it's just a good collective of folks that are willing to contribute. And Land and Legacy has contributed. We've had some of their consultants on there. So I've opened it up to everybody because it's a voice. It's an opportunity for people to communicate. And really what I've realized over time was, you know, there's always this paranoia and competitiveness. I'm like, am I good enough? Right. Everyone goes through that. Am I good enough? And I'm like, wow. You know, the more that I experience doing this, the more that I realize, wow, we are different. And like I said earlier, you know, I would love to hunt with you. You know, I would love to hunt with anybody that's even on the network, but it's just because you learn so much from people.
Right.
And I think, you know, your perspective, my perspective, there's nobody that's 100% right, but man, the level of just interest and focus, like I'm so passionate about my clients. I don't care about my hunting season anymore. There's so many things I don't care about anymore.
Yeah.
I just love changing things and I love helping people. And I can't stress that enough because I'm not always right, but I'm telling you, I will figure out what the best answer is every single time. Yeah. And I'm ingrained to figure out the right. We're right. Problem solvers. Men are problem solvers in most examples, and we're leaders. And so I want to be a leader in the industry. I do not have the social media presence that I probably need to be that leader, but I think over time I will. I think, you know, I am the next generation. The Grant Woods and Sturgis, they'll be gone in 10 years. Yeah, they'll be around, but they'll be gone. Some of these guys are doing it, they'll be gone. I'm the next generation and I need to be smart and work well with other people. And it's having great relationships that I need to focus in on. And, you know, these are the platforms to do that. And I feel very vulnerable saying that, but my business has grown this year. It's the biggest business. It's the most work I've ever had. I can't take on much more work. You know, I try to, and I will, but I'm super appreciative even of the network because it's given me a voice and platform. And I needed that. So, I thank you for considering me, man, because called me and I wasn't sure. So I think it worked out pretty good.
Yeah. I forget how that all went down, but I listened, to someone who I trusted say, dude, you got to talk to this dude. And it worked out great, man. And you're putting out amazing content. We do have to work on the social media aspect of it a little bit more, and we'll get there. But but dude, I really appreciate it, and I'm gonna do a commercial for Whitetail Landscapes right now. Okay, and it's very simple, and maybe you'll hate this, but I want people to call you. Okay, if you want big giant bucks on your hunting property, call John Teeter and Whitetail Landscapes. Do it. Right. Cause that's what people want is big bucks, and you can give them big bucks.
Yeah. That's my marketing advertising. I'm going to be the big sexy buck guy.
Yeah. The big bucks. Yeah. Big buck habitat management. I can just see it now. Well, John, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to come on here and talk habitat with us, talk consulting and things like that. That's like, self-admittedly, it's one thing that, because I've never owned a property, I've never leased a property. I planted a brassica food plot once that I definitely overseeded, and it didn't turn out the way I wanted. But outside of that, I've done nothing in the habitat world. And so it's always, I love talking with you because it's very interesting conversation. So good luck with the business and good luck this upcoming season, man.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries.
For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.